Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
I have to tee off on the NBA and the hypocrisy that is legion right now all over this league. And I got to tell you, this kind of blew my mind, to be honest, even for the NBA, which is absolutely and insanely hypocritical. Even for the NBA, I was blown away by how exactly hypocritical this actually was. The NBA, so let me kind of walk you through a process here, right? The NBA wants to rip its players, its coaches, its commissioner. They want to tear down America as aggressively as they possibly can and all of American institutions. That's basically what the NBA has become. They don't realize it, but they are one of the primary avenues of propaganda that China uses to attack the United States now. And I don't really have a problem with anybody sharing their political views, but what I would ask is that your political views remain consistent. And so this story, I think, is going to blow a lot of your minds, and you're going to say, why am I not hearing and reading about this everywhere, given all the woke media out there? The reason is because they protect the NBA, and they try to hide their insane hypocrisy from you. So the NBA has not said anything about China forever, right? They just avoid the entire subject ever since Daryl Morey, who at the time was the Houston Rockets general manager, ever since he supported democracy in Hong Kong. And by the way, after he supported democracy in Hong Kong, they ended up losing democracy in Hong Kong. So all those protesters not only deserved American support in Hong Kong, they also deserved the support of athletes, right? Well, the NBA has avoided mentioning anything about China. They shut up and dribble for Chairman Xi, all of their top players. But this, I want to give credit right off the top here to Nike. Because Nike came out recently and they said, we are not going to use cotton that is produced by slave laborers inside of Xinjiang province in China, where they are using Muslim slave laborers inside of concentration camps to produce cotton that is used by many different companies around the world, and certainly a lot of them in China. And Nike found out that its product was being made with slave labor cotton. Yes, slave labor cotton, even in 2021 in China. And they said, we are no longer going to allow our products to be made with Muslim slave labor in Xinjiang province in China. We will source our cotton elsewhere from free people. That got Nike criticized to the nth degree all over China, and people began to boycott Chinese people did Nike products in the country. And two different Chinese sneaker companies, Li Ning and Anta, both came out and said, we are going to use Chinese slave labor in the Xinjiang province to make our shoes. I want you to listen to me carefully here. They said they were going to use slaves who pick cotton to make their product. They doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on slave labor when they found out that Nike was saying they wouldn't use it, and people in China cheered, and they've been buying more of their product. Well, this is interesting because those two Chinese sneaker companies are paying tens of millions of dollars a year to many so-called woke NBA stars. In particular, Dwayne Wade, who is now retired, has a monster deal with one of these Chinese companies. Not only does Dwayne Wade have a monster deal, he has signed on others to be a part of his monster deal. CJ McCollum and D'Angelo Russell in particular are now a part of Dwayne Wade's slave labor prospects. All right? Also, how about Klay Thompson? He has an $80 million deal with a Chinese sneaker company that is using slave labor to make his shoes. So does his Warrior teammate, James Wiseman. I don't know about you, but Golden State Warrior head coach Steve Kerr, who always lectures us about politics, I'd be interested to know what he thinks about his players making tens of millions of dollars, even though both of those guys are injured right now, off of Chinese slave labor. I would also like to know what Laker LeBron James thinks about his teammate Alex Caruso making tens of millions of dollars alongside of other NBA players off of this Chinese shoe. I would also like to know what NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who allowed his players to have social justice warrior slogans on their jerseys last year, and who also put political slogans on the basketball court itself, thinks about the crazy hypocrisy here that they now are allowing NBA players to play their games wearing sneakers that were made by slaves in China. Is there in any way a defense of the NBA players who claim to be woke and in reality are wearing the product that is created by Muslim slaves? Literally, there are still slaves in China producing cotton. This is not just something that happened in the 1860s in the South. This is something that is going on today in China. And if you are an NBA player that is trying to argue that you won't shut up and dribble, that you're about more than basketball, that you're about more than just being an athlete, how in the world can this league justify slave labor produced products on its basketball court? And this to me is emblematic of the horrible hypocrisy that exists in the NBA right now, where the NBA players, coaches, league executives will criticize American institutions to the high heavens, but they won't say a word about what's going on in China because they want to continue to cash all these Chinese checks. And all of these NBA players who claim that they are so woke, how in the world can they justify playing and working for Chinese companies that are using slave labor to pick the cotton that is in the products that they are endorsing? It is the height of hypocrisy. You know what also is the height of hypocrisy? That almost no one else in the entire American sports media is going to point this out to you at all. Almost no one, I bet, who covers the NBA is even going to be willing to ask any of these players, coaches, league officials, or the commissioner about this hypocrisy at all. In fact, the NBA has declined comment on whether it thinks it's appropriate that some of its star players are wearing slave labor products endorsed by China. Remember, this is not some unintentional act where you find out, oh, we didn't know our product was being made this way, and we're going to change now the way that we source it. These Chinese sneaker companies know that they are using slave labor, Muslim slave labor from Xinjiang province in China, the Uyghur population. This is genocide that's going on there, and they have doubled down. They are using it intentionally, and they are trying to punish Nike in China for not using it. This is a wild story. this should be a monster story given what the NBA tries to do in the United States of America. They are being used by China and Chinese propaganda, and they aren't doing anything to try and fight against it. It's downright unacceptable and disgraceful. And yet, I bet this is the only place in all of American sports media, this show, and OutKick the website, that will actually cover and discuss this in detail. Ask yourself why that is, and also ask yourself why so many people in American sports are carrying water for China, why they are willing to shut up and dribble for Chairman Xi while ridiculing American institutions that are far more equitable, that are far more fair, that are far greater than all of the institutions in China. The NBA is doing China's bidding, and almost no one will even mention it in any way. It's disgraceful. All right. Had to hop on my soapbox this morning and tee off on this hypocrisy.
This is OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Here is Nick Saban telling the story of finally winning the hand of Terry Saban, going back to the reunion, seeing her old boyfriends, thinking he was going to make a statement, and instead, Miss Terry gets a walk-off here. But here is the clip of Nick Saban. This is him addressing, I think it's a coaching conference, maybe a couple of years old, but I saw it circulating on social media recently, grabbed it and shared it. Here it is, Nick Saban talking about his now wife's ex-boyfriends. Enjoy.
They had a homecoming day for Nick Saban. And all the guys I went to high school with and all the people, the family, you know, came to it. It was a big deal. And it was wonderful. It really was. But when I was a kid growing up, my dad owned a service station. And we lived in the country. And my wife, who was, I tried to date from the time I was in the seventh grade, she would never, ever date me. Never, ever go out with me. She had this guy named Mickey Schaefer that she was always boyfriend with. She was from the city. She went to East Fairmont. She was the queen bee, the drum majorette, and all that stuff. And, you know, I just could not get a date. And here I am, the country bumpkin out here, pumping gas every day. And it's, in those days, it's full service now. I mean, it's not like today. Somebody comes in, pumps your own gas, you collect the money. I mean, you had to clean the windows, check the oil, change tires, mufflers, grease cars. I mean, I was filthy, dirty, black fingernails all the time. Could never get a date. Could never get a date. So finally, when I got in high school, we were pretty good. We were just a class AA school. She went to a big AAA school. And we always played them and we beat them like a drum. But she finally noticed me. She finally noticed me. And I finally got a date. And she had dated this Mickey Schaefer guy for like 6 years. So when we go back for this reunion, lo and behold, Mickey Schaefer owns a service station. And Terry and I have been married for 42 years, so however many that was, minus five. So I said, I am not going to miss the opportunity to do a drive-by. Just to make sure she kind of knows how she picked. So we drive by Mickey Schaefer service station, and I said, see there, honey? There's your boy, Mickey Schaefer. I said, if you'd have married him, that's where you'd be now. She said, bullshit. If I'd have married him, he'd be the head coach at Alabama now. So.
Okay, this was great, right? For anybody that has been to a reunion and ever met the wife or the boyfriend's, the wife or the husband's ex-girlfriends or ex-boyfriends, this is fantastic. I can picture Nick Saban driving past the gas station that Terry Saban, her ex-boyfriend, now runs, and being like, hey, guess you lucked out there, right? And this is kind of a phrase that this storyline has gotten a lot of attention over the years. This is pretty interesting to see, as it's all kind of a story that, you know, a guy tries to brag, hey, you know, how much better you are because you ended up with me than if you hadn't. Dub, have you ever heard a story like this? The punchline is Terry Saban says, well, maybe if I'd have married him, he'd have ended up the head coach of Alabama instead of owning a gas station.
That's fantastic. I mean, she really did steal the show here.
I feel like she puts Nick Saban in his place well, because we see Nick Saban on the sideline, and he basically, even Paul Kaharsky kind of referenced it, Nick Saban at Alabama is sort of the dictator, right? I mean, that's why I think a lot of guys like being in college football. By the way, I should mention that the NCAA has passed a transfer rule. It'll be interesting if that changes any of the power that any of these coaches have, and we'll probably talk about this later on in the days and weeks ahead, this transfer rule. Heck, you know what? I'll probably talk about it at the end of maybe I'll talk about it in the second hour, because I got to give you an update on Deshaun Watson here in a minute, because there is a lot of news out about the Deshaun Watson case. But Nick Saban is such a dictator. He's such an all-powerful guy that I think a lot of people dub, and you know, because you went to Auburn, all over the state of Alabama and beyond, so many different people just see him as an all-powerful force. And Terry Saban is a very humanizing aspect of that for him. And her putting him in place there is pretty great. I thought it was so well played. And it's a little bit of a cliche, but I've never heard it told in that way involving a football coach. It's just fantastically well done.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Danny G has been hard at work in the review territory of the Outkick podcast. I want to thank all of you for all the 5-star podcast reviews that are going up. Encourage you, if you want to hear your name on the show, Danny G, reading your review, you need to go to look up Outkick, look up my name, Clay Travis, pop in a review, and you could be one of the big winners here of a 5-star t-shirt. It is an illustrious prize package indeed. Danny G, what you got for me?
I'm ready to go. Roberto, hit that music. And as you know, Clay, to give away these exclusive 5-star t-shirts, I like to start with a couple of 1-star reviews, actually, just to keep you humble.
Yes.
There's a problem, though. 5 stars rolling in nonstop, but not that many 1-stars.
Well, that's because, in all honesty, I mean, we see the ratings numbers and we see the downloads. It's because I'm America's sweetheart. Everybody loves me. I do, by the way.
Oh, no.
I recorded yesterday. We're doing a weekly I Hate You, Clay Travis. I don't really read much of my Twitter mentions anymore, but I've got a crew that basically goes through and finds, you know, the awful things that people say about me. And then they, you know, send me a 1 sheet, basically, with all of them. And then I go read them and react to them live in real time. It's pretty fun. So, that's what's going on.
Well, it's
right
actually,
now.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing you do on Outkick each week. I love your facial expressions after you read each one calling you a dirtbag. So I'm going to give a little I Hate You, Clay Travis here, because there wasn't any I Hate Yous on iTunes. I'm going to go to your Twitter, which, as you know, is just an endless,
endless
love fest.
Yes,
for you.
Yes.
All right, Clay Travis, this is from @MacDaddy is DAT1. You are such a sanctimonious hypocrite.
That's it?
Yeah, he used a big word. How do you feel, by the way, about the parody accounts? You've got plenty. Have you seen them?
No, I don't even know. I mean, as long as people know that they're parody accounts, I'm totally fine with them. You know, there were a lot of times for a while there where people were pretending to be me, and that is the ones where I'm like, well, we shouldn't have those. But if somebody is just creating a parody account, whatever. I mean, I could do a better parody account of me for sure.
Yeah, it's like the fake Schefter accounts. This one's not like that. This is called Outcap the COVID. Retro Clay Travis tweets at Outcap. He writes in a journal here, December 14th, 1864. Despite the Union's advanced fair porn, I'm showing that I'm not afraid to travel in Tennessee by going to my cabin in the mountains. Nashville remains the safest place in the Confederate States of America.
I also have a better historical knowledge than whoever is saying that. Nashville was very safe. It was the first southern capital, I believe, to fall to the Union. And so there was never any great danger in the city of Nashville, even with the war and the battle that happened in December of 1864. They never actually got into the city of Nashville and caused any trouble. So this is where my knowledge is far in excess of. I mean, I'm sort of a history nerd, so it's not only a big whiff, it's not even a smart whiff. Like, so that's the thing. I would be better. Like, I could create a Clay Travis parody account that was far funnier than anybody who has created a Clay Travis parody account so far.
Sounds like a Kevin Durant challenge to me. All right, I have a couple of T-shirt winners here. I'm going to start with Graffiti Ball 10,000. My man, five-star review. Despite his blatant pandering for five-star reviews, Clay is very knowledgeable about sports and politics. What more can you ask for in a daily show? He checks every box. Keep up the good work, CT.
I appreciate that. And I do love the five-star reviews. And I'd encourage you to go put your five-star reviews in.
Yep. And another T-shirt winner here from Fox Sports Rules on iTunes. Four Horsemen of Podcasts. His five-star review says, Rogan, Shapiro, Crowder, Travis. Travis overtakes my choice lately as my go-to for sports content. Don't pander to the woke, and you'll stay in my rotation. Who's Crowder?
Steven Crowder, I think. That's all three of those guys are super successful in the larger universe. In fact, I'm going on Ben Shapiro's radio show a little bit later after I finish my own radio show. So if you listen to Ben Shapiro, you will hear me on that program later today.
Yeah, I like Rogan. He's in my rotation. And then the last winner for this week from DFTF99, his title, Clay Travis is a Corona Bro Slayer. Five stars. Clay Travis discusses the biggest sports topics and does so for sports fans that care, not the woke loser Corona Bros that only aim to cancel everything. Danny G and the crew add lots of fun to the show, and the regular guests you bring on give great expertise. Petros, Isola, and Klatt are my favorites. Keep fighting the good fight against cancel culture and the woke sports BS. Thank you, Clay.
All right. I appreciate that. I would encourage all of you to go sign up and make sure that you give us five-star reviews as well. A lot of fun as we continue to break all that down. And a little bit of a tease, Danny G, tomorrow, we need an Animal Thunderdome. I have got one from my own backyard. All right. I want to tease this. I want everybody to be able to think about it. I was throwing baseball in the backyard with my 10-year-old yesterday, okay? And he comes running back over to me, and because we have, like, tall trees in the backyard, and the ball, like, went off his glove and went into the trees, and he went in to go get it. And he comes running back out, and he said, Dad, there's a headless rabbit behind the tree here. And I went in. And behind the tree, there is indeed a headless rabbit. So what killed the rabbit and what decapitated the rabbit? I have a fenced-in backyard, so I don't think it's a human move. I mean, if it's human, it's super creepy.
Oh, man.
But Animal Thunderdome style, I live in a neighborhood. It's not like I live, you know, in an area where there's tons of wild animals running around, right? What do we think killed the rabbit?
Oh, we gotta dissect this tomorrow.
I'm gonna take a picture. I'm gonna take a picture of the rabbit when I finish, and I will text it to the entire crew. The headless rabbit. We have a lot of rabbits in the neighborhood, but I don't even know what's violent enough to have taken the entire head off of the rabbit.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
We are joined now by Albert Breer of Sports Illustrated. We are officially 2 weeks from the NFL draft, the first round. And I got to be honest, I love that the NFL now breaks it out. First round on Thursday, rounds 2 and 3 on Friday and Saturday with the rest of the draft. I think it makes it so much more interesting to talk about after that first day, and also the excitement of all of those first round picks getting an equal amount of attention and just having those, I think is really cool. I wasn't sure if I was going to like it when they made that change. Albert, what do you think about that? How do you assess, now that we've had a few years of this, the Thursday night first round special?
It's great because, you know, I think, and honestly, I was sort of a skeptic myself because I, you know, my memories, and I think you're around the same age as me, were like of watching the draft like all day on Saturday. And I loved that when I was a kid, you know,
that's right.
And then you get rounds 4 through 7 on Sunday. So I was actually skeptical about it because I really liked the old way of doing it because I had such great childhood memories of it. But, you know, it really is good. And I think one of the cool things about it is it sort of promotes more movement. And on Thursday night, you get teams trying to move up into the bottom of the first round because they can get fifth-year options on guys. You know, and then, you know, from a reporter's standpoint, what's really interesting about it is, you know, on Friday now all of a sudden teams have a chance to kind of reset. And it's like, my God, this guy is still here. Do we go and get him? You know what I mean? Like, I think you saw it like last year with there was a little run on running backs with, you know, guys like DeAndre Swift, you know, and if you remember Clyde Edwards-Helaire came off the board at the end of Thursday night. And then all of a sudden, I think it was three or four running backs were off the board in the first 10 picks on Friday. So it's like kind of cool to me like that there's movement at the bottom of the round on Thursday because it's set up this way. And then on Friday, you know, teams have all day to talk to each other about moving up, moving down. And, you know, they really get a chance to kind of reset things. And again, like I think for a lot of teams, there's those moments where it's like, my God, I can't believe that guy's still there. Let's see what we can do to go and get him.
All right, so let's talk. I mean, there is pretty much guaranteed five quarterbacks to go in the first round. A couple of years ago, we saw something that I kind of feel like might become a trend, which is you get it. You tell, correct me if I'm wrong here, but under the existing contracts, I believe you get 4 years guaranteed for first round picks, and then you get a fifth year option, but only for first rounders, right? Given where we are with quarterback value, we know that five guys, and I'm going to unpack those with you here in a bit, but we know five guys are going to go in the first round, maybe in the top 10. Are you buying into the idea that Kyle Trask or Kellen Mond may also be at play late in the first round, or would it severely surprise you if a team were willing to take one of those guys in the first round?
Yeah, I'd be surprised, Clay. I mean, I think we may have more day two quarterbacks than usual. I'd throw Davis Mills from Stanford into that group, too, as somebody who I think's intrigued a lot of teams. But I have a hard time seeing a sixth first-round quarterback sneak in there.
First time since 1983, I think, by the way, if that happened.
I do think that there's a drop-off after the top five. And you know what's so interesting about it? And you can go back and look this up. There aren't very many second-round quarterbacks over the course of like the last 10, 15, 20 years. If you look at it, there are a ton of first-round quarterbacks and almost none in the second round. I mean, the number's really low. And you ask yourself why, and there are guys like Geno Smith, Christian Hackenberg. Well, it's actually kind of simple. It's either you think a guy is a franchise guy, and if you think he's a franchise guy, you're taking him in the first round, or you think the guy's a project or maybe a backup, a depth piece, whatever. And if that's the way you view a quarterback, then you probably aren't taking him in the second round, if that makes sense. You know, so I think what's unique and a little different about this year is you have the strength of the top at quarterback, but you also have the depth with some of these intriguing guys, which with a Mond, with a Trask, with a with a Davis Mills, some teams are going to look at those guys as backups, and I think the question becomes: is there a team there, you know, on the top of the second round that says it's worth taking a swing on this guy? Over a guy who, say, could be a starting receiver for you or a starting guard for you. That's what's so interesting about it, you know. So I don't think it's going to be more than five quarterbacks in the first round, but you never know. Somebody could, you know, at the end of the day decide, like, we're going to take a guy in the second round, and why don't we just trade up to the bottom of the first round so we get the fifth-year option on him? That's what happened with Teddy Bridgewater in 2014. That's what happened with Lamar Jackson in 2018.
Okay, we know Trevor Lawrence is going one. It seems pretty foregone conclusion. Zach Wilson is going number two.
Yeah.
Who do you ultimately think the 49ers are going to draft?
You know, I've been saying Mac Jones or Trey Lance, and now I'm like starting to doubt myself. I think Justin Fields might be in the mix. I do think that I will say this, like Mac Jones has a lot of qualities that Kyle Shanahan looks for in a quarterback. And, you know, I think there's a perception out there at least that Kyle wants to run an offense like a video game. And so he wants a guy in there who is going to be able to run his offense as it's being called and who is going to, you know, sort of color within the line, so to speak. And that's sort of the issue and has been the issue with Jimmy Garoppolo. You have the injuries, of course, and that is without question one of the problems. But another issue is that he freelances a little bit too much. And so, you know, I think for those reasons, it's really easy to say, okay, like, is it Mac Jones? And I think Mac Jones is under consideration. But then you consider what that offense has been able to do in the past. And when you look at, like, the truly great quarterbacks who made that offense where it is, and I know we all focus on Matt Schaub, and we focus on Kirk Cousins, and we focus on Matt Ryan. But if you look back to Kyle's dad, Steve Young, John Elway, you know what I mean? Like, so, and then you start to look at guys in Trey Lance and Justin Fields that have like those sorts of traits, that have like Steve Young, John Elway traits. Now, I'm not saying they're as good as those guys, but just physical traits. They've got stuff that makes you think that way. So, I firmly believe this, and I've been told this by multiple people in that organization, that when they made that trade, one of the reasons they made that trade a month ahead of time is so they could go out and vet these guys, so they could go out and look at these guys, so they wouldn't have to sneak around, and there wouldn't have to be any sort of subterfuge about going and getting all the information they possibly could on all of them. And so, you know, I can tell you Kyle thought going into the trade that there were five first-round quarterbacks. I can't tell you who he had ranked on top of who. You know, but I do think that they really did genuinely want to go through the process because on one hand, you've got a guy in Mac Jones who does fit the offense, who does fit what they look for in a quarterback. But then you've got, you know, Trey Lance and Justin Fields, who I think have the ability to supercharge it.
All right, so quarterbacks go in third. Do you buy into the idea that the Falcons would take a quarterback, or are you convinced, as I am, at least at this point 2 weeks out, that they are locked in on the idea of Kyle Pitts? Not to say that if somebody wanted to trade up, they might not be willing to go back, but I believe if they draft at four, they're taking Kyle Pitts. You buy that, or do you think the Falcons are doing something else?
I think it's in play. Like, I can tell you the discussion in that organization has sort of been about timelines.
Yeah.
Now, this makes sense. Like, you know, I think, you know, if what you do with that pick is going to determine your timeline. They've renegotiated Matt Ryan's deal again, and they've pushed money forward. And we're now, you know, it had been where, all right, it would be difficult to get out of the deal after this year. I mean, now what they've done is made it difficult to get out of the deal even after next year.
Yep.
So that tells you they're at least comfortable with Matt Ryan for the next few years. They aren't looking for an escape hatch. And I got to tell you, Clay, the thing is you look at that roster, and they need, there's no question, they need cheap young talent to fill it out. They need a lot of complementary pieces. But the top of that roster isn't bad. You know what I mean? Like, it's like there are a lot of first-round picks on the offensive line. You have Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley at receiver. On defense, you got guys like Grady Jarrett and Deion Jones. I just look at that roster. It's like, if you put Kyle Pitts in the offense, now all of a sudden, I mean, Arthur Smith can win in year one. And so that's part of the discussion there is timelines. It's if you draft a young quarterback, now you're resetting a little bit, and you're probably going to detach from some of that core, and it's going to be a 3 or 4 year or 5 year process, and that could pay off doing it that way. Whereas, you know, if you take Kyle Pitts, now you're okay. We're creating like a 2 or 3 year window for ourselves, and we believe we can win now. And I don't think it's a small thing. When you look at Terry Fontenot, the general manager there, look at what they did in New Orleans when they had that fantastic draft in 2017 and created a new window for themselves with guys like Alvin Kamara and Michael Thomas and Marcus Williams and Ryan Ramczyk. They completely created a new window for themselves with one draft. I could see where, you know, Terry Fontenot would say, we can do that here. We've got enough good players on hand where if we can add a few more pieces, like, we could be contending very, very soon.
Especially given, and it's wild to say, but 36, which I believe is Matt Ryan's age, it doesn't look that old relative to some of the other teams and what their quarterbacks have been capable of. Drew Brees, yeah. as you mentioned. We just had a Super Bowl winning quarterback in Tom Brady at 43. Aaron Rodgers just won MVP of the league at 37. Ben Roethlisberger certainly bounced back at, I believe, 38 and played at a fairly high level. And so if you think you got 2 or 3 years left of Matt Ryan, Kyle Pitts, I know you're a big college football fan too. Nobody could cover him in the SEC.
Yeah.
And if you have Julio Jones and you've got Calvin Ridley and you've got a pretty accurate passer in Matt Ryan, to me that trio offensively is pretty difficult to cover.
Yeah, I mean, like, and that's the thing about Kyle Pitts. Like, now, I will say, like, you know, there are a lot of people that really like Ja'Marr Chase in the league right now.
Yeah.
And I've talked to people who believe that Ja'Marr Chase is the best non-quarterback in the draft. Here's the bottom line, though. It's too easy to find receivers now. I mean, they're everywhere. You know what I mean? Like, if you look at the last 5 years and you compare the second-round receivers to the first-round receivers, there's almost no difference. You know what I mean? Like, that's just the way it's played out. You don't have tight ends like Kyle Pitts come along too often. Like, I've had people say he's the best tight end prospect since Vernon Davis. That was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so I think he could absolutely change, like, what they are offensively already, like, what a nightmare they could be to defend if they draft them. It totally makes sense for me. And here's a detail, too, that I think is interesting. I can tell you Terry Fontenot went out of his way to – meet with Matt Ryan early on, and we know how difficult these things are because of COVID now and all the rules and everything else. But he made a real effort to, like, he went to an event. They have a, you know, like this thing, this play, this complex that was opening on the Falcons property. He made a point of showing up at that event because he knew Matt Ryan was going to be there. And he's done a lot to try to relationship build with Matt Ryan. And I know Arthur Smith has too. And I mean, I don't know, Clay, like, if you're looking to move on from the guy, like, are you doing those things? You know what I mean? Like, I just there's a lot of things there that tell you, like, they are very much considering going forward for the next couple of years with Matt Ryan. On the flip side, they have had the cavalry at all the big quarterback pro days, so you know that they're kicking the tires on those guys too.
We're talking to Albert Breer, Sports Illustrated NFL writer. Unfortunately, this story you just can't escape. Last night, right. Tony Busby announces a 23rd woman has filed a lawsuit alleging that Deshaun Watson sexually assaulted her. And all of these women, to my knowledge, I haven't read all of the amended complaints, but he says in that statement that all of the women have now identified themselves. They aren't anonymously filing anymore for purposes of these lawsuits. What are you hearing from NFL people about the Texans' positioning with Deshaun Watson, about how the NFL is responding to this, and how you see it playing out, not from a legal perspective, but just from a Deshaun Watson quarterback perspective?
Yeah, I can't. I mean, like, you know, and I think I've said this to you before. Like, I think it's hard to have a take on it because, I mean, if you have a take on it or too hard to take on it, you're either indicting Watson, which I don't think is fair, or you're not taking the allegations seriously enough. Need the allegations to be taken very seriously, you know? So, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I can tell you, like, the Texans tone on this thing has changed, and I don't know the exact point when it happened. Well, it was over the last few weeks. Like, and I think if you called the Texans 5 or 6 weeks ago and asked them like about trading Deshaun Watson, I know the response to other teams was, you can ask us about anybody but the quarterback.
Yeah.
Now, if you call him now and you have something creative, like hey, let's work out a deal and condition some picks, like, you know, a 2022 pick, a 2023 pick that are conditioned on him playing, not being suspended, whatever. Like, I think the Texans are listening now. You know, I think the Texans would be more than open to those sorts of things. The issue now becomes the Texans can't. It'd be really hard for them to move on from Deshaun Watson without getting a historic haul in return, because he's a 25-year-old franchise quarterback. And I don't know that any other franchise is going to have its owner, and I think that's an important point here, its owner sign off on doing that sort of thing until there's clarity on the legal situation. So I think the Texans are more open to it than they had been. And I mean, I think because of that, like, whenever this thing gets settled, and we'll see what happens, if Deshaun Watson is cleared or if there's some settlement that allows him, you know, to play football soon again, it does seem like the Texans might be more open to moving on than they were even a month ago. And I just think it's worth monitoring because, I mean, you got a law background. I wouldn't be surprised if there are people telling Deshaun, just do whatever you can to settle these cases now.
That's what I would be telling him. I mean, I talked about this earlier in the show, Albert. I said, look, if you ask me to put my lawyer hat on and I'm not considering anything other than representing my client and advising him in the best possible way that I could, you got to settle these cases and you got to pay whatever the price is. Could be tens of millions of dollars now, because if you don't, you may have criminal charges. You may take yourself out of being able to play for years. You may face time in prison. And so he is painted into such an awful legal corner that that's the only solution that I see for him at this time. You can't go to court for 23 different cases and try to defend yourself in a court in front of a jury. Some of those juries are going to find you responsible. All right, last question for you. NFL draft is 2 weeks away. Who are guys out there that you think can be instantaneous difference makers that our audience may not know in the first or early in the second round that you are hearing a lot of outstanding buzz about?
Yeah, there are a couple. One of them is kind of funny. I would not be surprised if the fourth receiver off the board is Elijah Moore from Ole Miss.
He's a stud. And I think he is a stud. Yeah.
Now, you know, people might know him best for his celebration in the Egg Bowl a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he's the one for people out there who have forgotten who raised his leg. But you know who he was emulating is A.J. Brown. And A.J. Brown may be a top 5 or 10 wide receiver in the NFL already. So, honestly, I actually look at the Titans at 22 as a potential destination for him because Corey Davis is gone. He has a good rapport with A.J. Brown. They need a slot receiver. But so you can explain why you're hearing good things about him.
So it wouldn't surprise me. It's just, I mean, like, it's one of those things where you start to ask around, and I was surprised to hear his name in front of, you know, the Rashad Batemans, the Rondale Moores. And then it started to be like, could he be the fourth receiver off after the two Alabama guys and Chase? And then I started asking around more, and it's just like everybody I talk to loves him. You know what I mean? Like, so he's one, absolutely. I think another surprise could be J.C. Horn, who, is, you know, the kid of Joe Horn. I wouldn't be totally stunned if he was the first corner off the board. Caleb Farley, who I think would have been the first corner otherwise out of Virginia Tech, he's got the back issue that's going to scare some teams off. Patrick Surtain's a really good player, really safe player, but there are questions about his ceiling. Whereas J.C. Horn, sort of, and that's Joe Horn's son, corner from South Carolina, he was just a freakish athlete. Was a really good player to begin with and might have, you know, more in his bag, so to speak. So J.C. Horn would be another one. And then, you know, I think the guy that could go a little bit higher than people expect, I haven't heard a lot on him, and maybe even in front of Micah Parsons, because there are, a few questions about makeup and character with him, is Zaven Collins, the linebacker from Tulsa, who is, I mean, I heard him compared to Tremaine Edmonds, who's obviously become a star with the Bills now. And the comp I got, which is sort of interesting, is he's big like Tremaine Edmonds, maybe not quite the freakish athlete, but his college tape is better than Tremaine Edmonds' college tape. So he's one that I've just sort of looked at and said, I didn't have him in my mock a couple weeks ago, and now I'm wondering if he could, like, go in the late teens. So those would be three guys that I think I would say NFL teams think a little higher of than the general public. Elijah Moore, J.C. Horn, and Zaven Collins.
Man, I love the NFL draft, and I can't wait for 2 weeks from now when all this starts to come off the board and we find out exactly what's happening. Albert, I know how much you work. I know how busy you are. I appreciate the time, man. You're fantastic every time you come on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks, Clay.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.